listening to Left Call Radio, the Liberal Politics Now podcast, hailing from just outside the cradle of liberty, the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm your liberal as always host, David Sutton. So sit back with a cup of Joe, because episode 8 starts now.
10 days ago, the world watched in horror as men, women, and children were massacred in Syria in the worst chemical weapons attack of the 21st century. Yesterday, the United States presented a powerful case that the Syrian government was responsible for this attack on its own people. Our intelligence shows the Assad regime and its forces preparing to use chemical weapons, launching rockets in the highly populated suburbs of Damascus, and acknowledging that a chemical weapons attack took place. And all of this corroborates what the world can plainly see. Hospitals overflowing with victims, terrible images of the dead. All told, well over 1,000 people were murdered.
So that was President Obama speaking from the Rose Garden, telling us why we need to go to war with Syria. Oh, of course, the administration doesn't want to call it a war, but if you're lobbing cruise missiles at a country, I call that war. So he talks about the images we've seen on TV of dead bodies and at least 1,000. Now it's been confirmed that over 1,400 killed from chemical weapons. And that is our reason, because Obama drew a red line that he now says wasn't his red line. It's the world's red line. And while he's technically true, 1925, much of the world agreed to ban the use of chemical weapons. But are we overlooking the 100,000 people that have already died in the Syrian civil war? Are we making light of that by only focusing on the 1,400 killed by chemical weapons? It's all horrible, and I think it's ridiculous that we make such a distinction. Secretary of State John Kerry said, "What we saw in Syria last week should shock the conscience of the world." I agree, but so should any image of war. The problem is just that. We don't see the images of war when it's conventional weapons use. I mean, we see blown out buildings. Maybe we may see dead bodies from afar, but we really don't see it. And let's face it, people that are on ground zero from a conventional weapon, there's not much left. But there's horrible disfigurement, horrible death, horrible suffering from so-called conventional weapons. But we're supposed to be horrified by chemical weapons. And the reason we're horrified is because we do see those people on TV, because they have no clear external injuries. We just see people suffering in hospital beds, and we see rows of bodies, all intact, all their fingers and toes, all their limbs, fully intact. And that is the horrifying image. And yes, it is a horrifying image. The problem is, like I said, we don't see the effects of conventional warfare. And I'm afraid by countries coming together to ban chemical weapons, we've sort of given ourselves a license to use bullets and bombs to kill people. We call chemical weapons use a war crime. Why don't we call conventional weapons use a war crime? Oh, I know that sounds silly. That would mean there couldn't be war. Exactly. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that that actually would happen, that there wouldn't be war, but I don't like the idea that we make this seemingly arbitrary distinction. Because chemical weapons actually are not a good weapon of war, and that is actually the rationale for making them, for banning them, for making it a war crime to use them. But there is a counter view on this, that because they're not effective weapons of war, that's why they're the ones that were easy to ban. That's definitely a counter view. I don't know if I buy it or not, but it wouldn't surprise me. But yes, we should be outraged over the use of chemical weapons. We should be enraged that a regime cares so little about its citizens. But I still ask, why do chemical weapons change the equation? Again, over 100,000 people have died from conventional warfare. And now we have nearly 1,500 dead from chemical weapons. Both weapons result in fatalities. I fail to see the distinction. But more importantly, I fail to see how sending a few cruise missiles to Damascus is going to change anything. Unless we could know for sure we were going to wipe out all their chemical weapons capabilities, what are we going to change? We're going to send a message? That's what we're going to do? That's what we hear all the time. We have to send a message. We have to send a strong message. America has to send a strong message. If we don't do anything, we'll be seen weak by the world. We'll be seen weak by the tyrants, by the dictators. I think we do a bit too much caring about what tyrants and dictators think of America. But if you ask me, the world appears to be deaf to American brute force as a tool of communication. I mean, look at the military action that we've taken really over the past few decades. Has it really changed that much in the countries we took that action in, or the world? Have we sent a strong message to the tyrants and dictators of the past that we are no longer producing tyrants and dictators in the world? And before we get involved in yet another war, you should check out a piece by Paul Walden on the American prospect. And he adds up that there have been 15 separate episodes of war that include Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, as well as other military actions that we didn't call wars in Grenada, Haiti, Panama. And America has averaged some kind of military strike or war every 40 months since 1963. I'd say the world's not listening to us. So I ask again, what will war in Syria change? Because unless we're going to commit to a full-scale war with ground troops and all, and to actually take out Assad, which I'm not advocating, but that's the only way you would affect any kind of change, is Bashar Assad suddenly going to change course, lay down his arms, stop killing his country's citizens just because we sent a couple cruise missiles his way? It seems, if anything, that would make him more likely to continue his path. I mean, what does he have to lose? If we're not going in there to take him out, I don't see how that's going to cause him to change direction. To say, you got me. I've been a bad boy. I guess I'll play nice now. It's just silly. So what we're really doing is we're saving face. Obama set a red line. America is the lone superpower. That means we have to send a strong message. It always comes back to that. That's what this is about. Obama can say whatever he wants about it. Kerry can say whatever he wants about it. And all the chicken hawk pundits that come out of the woodwork that start clucking when they get any scent of war, they can say what they want about it. But this is really just about America looking tough. That's what we got to do. We got to send that strong message. But let's get back to that 1925 agreement among the world's countries to never again use chemical weapons. Do the humane rules of war, and that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about rules of war. They established a red line, as Obama called it, that we would not cross in warfare. But do these humane rules make it easier to start wars? Make it more justifiable to use anything but a chemical weapon? There's a good piece on the Washington Post, 9 Questions About Syria You Were Too Embarrassed to Ask, by Max Fisher, who is he's the Washington Post's foreign affairs blogger. And he goes through the basics, like question number 1, what is Syria? Which sounds like a stupid question, but you have to know that most people probably couldn't find Syria on a map. Question 2, why are people in Syria killing each other? But it's question 8 that I'd like to focus on. Question 8 says, Come on, what's the big deal with chemical weapons? Assad kills 100,000 people with bullets and bombs, but we're freaked out over 1,000 who may have died from poison gas. That seems silly. And he goes on to say, you're definitely not the only one who thinks the distinction is arbitrary and artificial, but there's a good case to be made this is a rare opportunity, at least in theory, for the United States to make the war a little less terrible and to make future wars less terrible. The whole idea that there are rules of war is a pretty new one. The practice of war is thousands of years old, but the idea that we can regulate war to make it less terrible has been around for less than a century. The institutions that do this are weak and inconsistent. The rules are frail and not very well observed. But one of the world's few quasi-successes is the norm. A fancy way of saying a rule we all agree to follow against chemical weapons. This norm is frail enough that Syria could drastically weaken it if we ignore Assad's use of them. But it's also strong enough that it's worth protecting. So it's sort of a low-hanging fruit. Firing a few cruise missiles doesn't cost us much, but can maybe help preserve this really hard-won and valuable norm against chemical weapons. In response to Max Fisher's piece, I wrote a blog post titled Counterview, Do Humane Rules of War Make It Easier to Start Wars? And while I understand the idea behind a norm or a rule of war, because don't get me wrong, it's not that I find this issue to be simple to come to a conclusion on. It's not that I'm an advocate of chemical weapons use, but a norm of war, I feel like it serves to perpetuate war. Because in the case of chemical weapons, our immediate reaction of shock and disgust serves to temper our reaction to conventional warfare. I mean, there's been a war going on in Syria for the last 2 years and barely anyone's talking about it, but all of a sudden it's front page news because of chemical weapons use. And rightfully so, but maybe it should have been front page news when it was conventional weapons use as well. And that's my point. And I know it's not the intention, or at least I would hope it's not the intention, at least not of people of good character on this issue. I don't think it would be their intention to lessen the impact of conventional warfare. But putting so much emphasis on chemical weapons, I think opens the door for us to look the other way with conventional weapons in war. And now you might be saying, what am I saying? We should go to war? We should have gone to war in Syria 2 years ago? No, I'm not saying that. I think that leads me to my next point of what will we accomplish? Can we stop what's happening? And I guess if we threw enough of our military resources at it, maybe we could affect some kind of change. Although in the process, how much collateral damage would there be? So sure, we could take out Assad, change the course of their civil war, but we can't know what the outcome would be of doing that. We can't say it would even be better. So we would accomplish the goal of taking out Assad, possibly killing hundreds of thousands more people in the process, maybe worse. And then there still would probably be civil war going on in that country for decades to come. So sometimes maybe you just have to let things work themselves out naturally. There's an uprising in Syria. That's what started all this. Assad fought back, and maybe they just got to work it out. Because unless you can show me with great evidence that conducting some kind of military strike in Syria is going to change the course of that civil war, and no one is saying that. That's the way you have to understand this. No one is saying that that will be the case. Then I fail to see the point of sending cruise missiles to teach Assad a lesson. So to get back to that norm of war when it comes to a ban on chemical weapons use, can you conduct a war humanely? I know it sounds ridiculous to ask that question, but that's kind of what we're saying when we say, we need to act because there was chemical weapons use, because this is inhumane. Well, war is inhumane. And then there's the moral high ground platitude that people use. We need to take the moral high ground. And somehow, sending a few cruise missiles into a country, creating more destruction, it's taking the moral high ground. This one boggles the mind. I mean, do we stamp a moral high ground guarantee on each of those cruise missiles before we launch it at Syria? How does that work exactly? Like I said before, this is war. You send bombs into a country, you're committing an act of war. We have not been attacked. We are not defending ourselves. So, in a sense, if we do this, and I hate to agree with Vladimir Putin, it's a war crime. That's what we're planning to do. And when it's all said and done, is the rest of the world supposed to applaud the United States in another fine show of saber rattling followed by violent aggression? Do the families of Syrians killed by American cruise missiles thank us right after burying their dead relatives? Or is there a customary waiting period? Do our geopolitical foes cower, change course, congratulate the U.S. in a fine show of aggression that has changed their hearts and their minds? So before the Senate and the House vote on resolutions authorizing war, I suggest an amendment. This amendment will state that for every $1 we spend on death and destruction in Syria, we will spend $10 each for education, infrastructure, healthcare, oh, and mini cruise missile replicas for the kids. This amendment will also stipulate that we cut the defense budget by an equal 10-to-1 ratio. Let the gutless practitioners of war, human suffering, and exploitation, otherwise known as the U.S. Congress, vote on their war resolution with this new amendment attached. Because for as much as the military-industrial complex needs a reason to exist, the only thing that matters more to our representatives is making sure we do not spend money on the things that matter. Things like a modern infrastructure for a strong future economy, universal health care, and making sure people in economic distress are not left behind. You know that's a showstopper for them, particularly for Republicans. So I propose this amendment because it's the most certain way that I can come up with for Congress not to authorize war with Syria. Still not convinced that this is a really bad idea? How about five incredibly misguided arguments for military action in Syria? The first argument is the so-called credibility argument that America cannot be seen as weak. I've talked about this already. We have to send a strong message. And this is what all the pundits and war hawks are parroting on various news shows. And I agree with MSNBC's Chris Hayes when he said that that's a lousy reason to go to war, because we have to send a message or make sure that we don't look weak in the eyes of tyrants. The second argument is the future tyrant argument. It's the idea that if America doesn't send a strong message that you cannot use chemical weapons, future dictators will use these weapons of mass destruction at will. But there's not much evidence to support this argument. I mean, remember our friend Saddam Hussein? And he was our friend at one time. He used chemical weapons and we did nothing. And then no one else used chemical weapons for 2 decades. The third argument is the one I've already touched on. That's the humanitarian argument. 1,500 people died in a horrible death by chemical weapons. So we must do something about that. Well, it is horrible. But to do something means what? What's the outcome? I mean, remember, 98,500 additional Syrians have also died in this civil war from horrible deaths by conventional weapons. If we could somehow prove that military action would stop the death toll from all weapons, maybe, and I mean just maybe, it could be justified. But I have not heard anyone posit such an argument, because even though we have plenty of wrongheaded arguments for military action in Syria, Nobody is so deluded to think the Syrian conflict will end because of American intervention. The fourth misguided argument is that Assad will change course. If we send a strong message to President Bashar al-Assad, he will stop using chemical weapons. Really? Why would he do that? I mean, he already knew that we said we would do something if he used them, and he used them. So, unless we wipe out his entire stockpile, we can bomb him. He can still use them. I fail to see how that makes him change course. And the fifth misguided argument is the Geneva Protocol, which is that 1925 agreement that countries decided that they would not use chemical weapons in warfare. It would have been nice if countries decided not to have warfare, but I know, I'm a silly liberal that way, in thinking that way. And sure, chemical weapons are horrible. But you don't have to marginalize your morals by establishing an arbitrary standard for how to conduct war. There should be no war. Sending a message attached to a side of a cruise missile stating that killing people with chemical weapons is wrong. I have to tell you, that's also wrong. Any humanitarian should see the moral compromise we make by deeming one weapon of war unacceptable, leaving the remaining weapons as viable options. And so right about now, you're probably thinking, what are the alternatives? I mean, there is the option of just doing absolutely nothing. But there are also other options. And none of them are good options, but neither is war. So we should probably consider them. We could continue to put pressure on Syria's allies, particularly Russia. We could impose more economic sanctions against Syria. Although this particular idea, I kind of feel like isn't much better than war, because usually these sanctions affect the innocent people and not the regime. But it's still an alternative. America could offer to accept Syrian refugees. There's something like 2 million refugees spread across something like half a dozen other countries in the Middle East. We could offer more aid in the form of money, resources, and food. And we could offer them whatever it would take for them to have some semblance of a normal life. We can spend money where it will truly aid the victims of Assad's war crimes instead of more war. And the last option, the last alternative option to war, would be convicting Assad of war crimes. There is a international criminal court, which apparently my understanding is the United States is not signed on to, I guess because we like getting involved in a lot of wars, and we wouldn't want to be tried for any war crimes ourselves. But if you could get a conviction, it would allow seizure of Assad's assets from foreign banks. And if anyone who was convicted, Assad or members of his regime, if they were to travel to nations that have signed on to the ICC, the International Criminal Court, if they travel to those countries, they could be arrested, which I guess, oddly enough, means that maybe they wouldn't be arrested if they traveled to the United States, since we haven't signed on. I guess they would still be arrested. And sure, any of these actions would not physically remove Assad from power, but neither will a few cruise missiles. We say we want regime change, but we're not going to do anything to affect that change. But these are alternatives to conducting more warfare and having more innocent lives lost. And the last point I'd like to make on the whole Syrian conflict and the beating of the war drums, it's a response to an article on the Daily Beast by Michael Tomosky. The article title is, Do Liberals Enable Tyrants? Well, first of all, it's a provocative title, and I applaud him or the Daily Beast, whoever came up with that. But I reject the premise. Tomosky writes, what is liberalism supposed to be on the world stage? What values and goals do American liberals wish to promote around the world? I'm pretty certain most would say free democratic societies, full political rights for ethnic minorities, equal rights for women and, with any luck, gay people, a free press, an independent judiciary, and so forth. And where those cannot be achieved, at least a base level opposition to tyranny, reaction, religious fundamentalism, and so on. Most would name these things, but I have to say, most rank and file liberals do not seem to me to be very passionate about them. What most liberals are passionate about is one thing: opposition to U.S. militarism. That's putting a whole lot of people in a box, isn't it? We're not passionate about anything else other than that. I mean, when we're not beating the war drum like Tomasky seems to be doing with his piece, we rarely even talk about war. So obviously when the war drum starts beating and when our president's trying to take us into another war, well, of course we're going to be skeptical. And we have every reason to be skeptical given Iraq. And I don't care that it's a different president. In many ways, this president's been the same when it comes to thrusting U.S. power about the world. What Tomasky is doing is engaging in the typical drumbeat of war. We're told of all the possible horrible outcomes of not waging war. We're told we are focusing too much on the negatives of war and not the negatives of inaction. But I say it's simple. If you want war, then okay, you need to make your case for war based on the facts we know, not speculation of what could happen in another country at some possible later date. And since Tomasky's argument for war is largely based on this speculation, and because war should always be a last resort, if we use it at all, I reject the entire premise. But let's be truthful. This premise, it's really a cloak masking the real argument that America must not look weak, that America's perception must remain that of a strong nation, responding with great fury and military might in every corner of the world. But the last time I checked, our leaders and the pundits who support them to a fault have a horrible track record when it comes to predicting outcomes of wars and limited military strikes, which is also war. The only thing we do know for sure is that our predictions are often wrong and that these tyrants are some of the least predictable souls inhabiting the planet. Tomasky says if the United States does not act, it will embolden Assad. And this is the core of his entire argument. All the points he goes down about what could happen, it all comes down to emboldening somebody and somebody reacting in a way because America didn't act strong. As dictators go, as Assad goes, being emboldened is a prerequisite for the job. A dictator who is not emboldened will not hold on to that position for long. And a U.S. military strike is not going to change this. A ruthless Middle East leader who has killed 100,000 people in his own country is not going to be swayed or change his demeanor because of an act of reciprocal aggression by the West. Unless we plan to take him out, and that's not on the table right now, you can toss this emboldened argument out the window. Tomasky says we will radicalize the rebels with our inaction. Did any of you catch that video of a rebel eating a human heart? That seems pretty radical to me. I'm not sure how much more radicalized you can get. Tomasky also says a lack of U.S. action will be a win for Hezbollah. And he uses more of this emboldened logic, as I said. And my reaction to this is, we Americans are mighty high on ourselves, thinking everyone around the globe plans their actions only after careful consideration of what the U.S. may or may not do. And so there's no reason to even go through the rest of his points, because as I said, they're all based on this premise of, we need to act strong to send a message so that others fall in line around the world, like as if that's ever worked. But strangely, Tomasky does have a moment of clarity near the end of his piece when he says, yes, an American attack might escalate matters, but it also might not. Well, there you have it. The best argument I've ever heard for war. Yes, America is the lone superpower in the world, and that many times has meant that we become the world police. But usually it's of our choosing. We can choose not to always play that role, because our superpower status has a lot more to do with our wealth and our military than it does with the idea that we can actually change hearts and minds around the world by using that military. Thrusting American military prowess upon a country as a teachable moment for the rest of the region is a strategy the U.S. has deployed for much of the last century in the Middle East. And what exactly have we achieved? You can't force dictators or an entire people to join the 21st century if they're not ready to. And you certainly can't do it by using 20th century tactics. It just doesn't work. It would be nice if we could one day learn that. Well, that concludes this episode of Left Call Radio. Don't forget to like us on Facebook at facebook.com/theleftcall and on Twitter at twitter.com/theleftcall. And remember, we don't break the news. It's already broken. Catch you later.